I read of a tombstone that had carved upon it these words: "Pause, stranger, as you walk by, as you are now, so once was I, as I am now, so you will be." And someone had scratched under that, "To follow you, I'm not content till I know just which way you went." You know, all of us are going in one direction or another in eternity. And it is a wise person who considers that destination before the end of life comes. But the Bible says, it's appointed a man once to die, and after this the judgment. Hebrews 9:27. So once the death comes, the door of opportunity for change has closed. In Jesus' parable in Matthew 25, of the virgins, the wise virgins, the foolish virgins, he said that when the bridegroom came, the wise virgins went in with him, and the door was shut. Matthew 25:10. That represents the door of death, or the door of opportunity, being shut. And all of us one day will find that to be the case. Now, it can be shut before death comes. That's only one of the ways the door can be shut. But it is the way that most often it is. But it also can be shut if I am rendered mentally incapable of obeying the gospel. You know, there are some people who outlive their minds. They no longer are able to make a rational decision. And often that doesn't happen, you know, like a light switch. It's more like a dawning or a setting of a sun. But whenever that day comes when I no longer can make a decision, then the door of opportunity has closed for me. Another way that the door can be shut is when Jesus comes again. You know, He's going to come as a thief in the night. He's going to come in the twinkling of an eye. And that means that when Jesus comes, that generation will not have to die. But also, when the angel announces the return of Jesus, there will be no more invitation songs. There will be no more baptisms. There will be no more prayers. It will be over just as quickly as you could snap your finger or blink your eye. When Jesus comes, the door of opportunity is closed. And as far as I can tell, everything that had to happen before Jesus returned has happened. There is nothing now that must happen before Jesus comes again. That was not always the case, because there are some prophecies in the New Testament, the falling away first that Paul talked about, the man of sin being revealed, the gospel going out, all those things were talked about. But now all those things that were prophesied have come to pass, so Jesus could come back at any time. And I know preachers have been saying this since Jesus went back to heaven, but it is possible that we will not finish this service tonight, that Jesus may come. Now, you may say, well, I heard somebody, preacher, say that when I was just a kid. It didn't happen then. It hasn't happened yet. But somebody sometime is going to say that, and it's going to happen. It might be tonight, or it may be 1,000 years from tonight. But whenever that day comes, we must be ready. Now, tonight's lesson is entitled "A Mystery Ticket to Eternity." That comes from American Airlines. Some years ago had what they called a mystery ticket promotion. You could go to any of their counters in an airport, push $69 across the counter, and they would give you a sealed envelope with a ticket. And you could go for a weekend or a week, however long you wanted to stay. And a lot of people took that promotion and got away on a vacation, or maybe a honeymoon getaway with a spouse, or an anniversary getaway. But not everybody was happy with what they got. There was one guy seen walking through an airport holding up tickets, and he said, "I've got 2 tickets to Mall of America. I'll trade for anything." You know, his idea of a weekend getaway was not going shopping at the Mall of America. But I want to take that idea tonight. A mystery ticket. If you had in your possession tonight a ticket that represented your eternal destiny, Now, there are only two. There's a red one and a blue one. What color would yours be tonight? Do you have a ticket to that eternal city of light where God dwells, where there is no night? Or do you have a ticket to that lake that burns with fire and brimstone, where there is eternal darkness and weeping and gnashing of teeth? Now, those are the only two destinations. Now, you might not know tonight for sure where your ticket goes, but let's talk about those tonight and you make a decision. Luke chapter 16 is one of the most sobering chapters to be found anywhere in the biographies of Jesus. Some people believe this to be a parable. It's possible that it is. I don't believe that it is, though, because if it is a parable, it would be unusual. It does not follow the parabolic formula. The kingdom of heaven is like unto, and then Jesus tells a story. And it's not identified as a parable, as often they are. Jesus spake a parable unto them, saying. And if it is a parable, it's the only parable that uses actual historical characters. Abraham is mentioned, for instance, in this story that Jesus gave. My judgment is that Jesus, who came from eternity and was going back to eternity, has pulled back the curtain just for a moment that we might look beyond the grave. Did you know that a child with an open Bible can learn more about the afterlife in 15 minutes than the philosopher can learn in a lifetime in the greatest libraries of the earth? Because the wisdom of men can't tell you anything about where we're going. Oh, there's wisdom of the world that may affect us and benefit us in this life, but it's all speculation beyond this life. But a child or an adult reading the Bible can know in just a little while things that can only be known by revelation from God. Only be known from Jesus, who came from there and told us about it and went back there. And that's what we have in Luke chapter 16. Whether it's a parable or whether it's an account, either way, that's the case. He is showing us what happens beyond the grave. Now let's do this tonight. If you are able to visualize as you listen to someone speak, I'd like for you to visualize first a child's seesaw. Can you do that? You have that picture in your mind? You have two characters in this story that Jesus told. There's the rich man and Lazarus. And this seesaw, in the first picture that we have of three, rich man's up, poor man's down. Rich man's up, Lazarus is down. Let's read about that in Luke 16, beginning of verse 19, where Jesus says, "There was a certain rich man." Now, his name is not given here, perhaps representing the fact that he lost his identity. At least there was no, he was still who he was, but Lazarus got to keep his name, as we'll notice. But the rich man, he's called Dives if you read the commentaries, and that's just the Latin word for rich man, so it's not really a name. But here you have the rich man, and how is he described? "And there was a certain rich man which was clothed in purple and fine linen." Now, it is possible that you chose to wear a purple garment tonight. You just looked in your closet, pulled out something, a dress or a shirt or a tie. And we don't think anything about purple. It's just another one of those colors that we might wear, but it was different back then. Do you remember that Lydia in Acts 16, 14 and 15 was a seller of purple? What that means is that she sold clothes that had been dyed purple. It was very expensive. That was high-end merchandise. You had to have a good bit of money to get into that business, and the profits were good from that kind of business because they extracted that purple dye from a shellfish that could only be obtained or found at 15 feet of water or more. And so it was hard to get them. And you only got a little bit out of a seashell. You can imagine how much it would take to dye an entire man's robe with a little extract from a seashell. So not anybody could afford to wear purple except the rich folks, senators, kings, the very rich. So here is a man who is clothed in purple. If you saw him in a crowd, he would stand out because of his garment. You could say, that man's worth a lot. Look what he's wearing. And it also says he wore fine linen. That would be his undergarment. This was imported from what I've read from down in Egypt, and it was so light to the touch, so comfortable. It was called woven air. It was very comfortable. So here's a man. The picture is he has the best clothing that money could buy. Ostentatious outwardly, comfortable inwardly. Now you continue in this and it says, and fared sumptuously. That means he ate well. He ate as much as he wanted and it was good food. It says he fared sumptuously, not on Sundays when all the family gets together around the table and has a big meal together. Not on Thanksgiving when everybody's in, or Christmas when everybody's there and it's the big meal. And not just those days, not when the son or daughter's in from college and mom makes all the favorites and puts them on the table and grandparents come over and it's a great meal and everybody gets up thinking, I just can't eat another bite. Not fared sumptuously once in a while, but he fared sumptuously every day. Best clothes to wear, best food to eat, all he wanted to eat. This man is in an easy circumstance. We also notice, although this is not directly brought out, that he has a house, a dwelling place, that is large enough and fancy enough to have a gate. You might picture a courtyard with a wall around it, and there's a gate where he can enter and leave, and that's where Lazarus is going to be. Going to be when we see him in this first picture. So, fine clothes, plenty to eat. We picture a nice house. Now, all of us might say, well, that sounds like a pretty good living to me. Now, there's a contrast. It'd be hard to find a greater contrast between two individuals than what we see here, because in the next verse it says, and there was a certain beggar. There are two words for beggar, as I understand it in the original language. One is tokos. We would say working class poor. By getting up early, working long hours, he's able to scrape together a living for himself and his family. Just barely gets by. He's poor. There was another word for poor, penes. You hear our word penny in it. I got those backwards. Penes is the worker. Tokos is the word for beggar. You know, you picture someone on the street corner, people passing by a cup, holding out, can you spare a little change? Not able to earn a living, not able to barely squeak by, but wholly at the mercy of the generosity of other people. And this man, it says, which was laid at his gate, laid at the rich man's gate. It's a little stronger than that. The word laid, it's the word balo. It's the word for throw. So you picture this man who someone has brought to the rich. Maybe he was begging at some other street corner and the business owner there or the homeowner said, yeah, you got to get out of here. And so he drags him down the street and plops him down in front of the rich man's house. You beg here. So you see that he's not mobile. He's not able to go of his own volition where he wants to go. Someone has to bring him. And he's near death because he's about to die. So his health has failed. And not only is he immobile and a beggar, but it also says, laid at his gate full of sores. We think of another Bible character in that situation, Job, who sat on the ash heap or at the city dump and scraped himself with a piece of broken pottery. He had sore bowls. Well, that's the same idea here. His name means God is my help. And perhaps that indicates that he had good parents that gave him a good name. But now he really needs the help of God, doesn't he? Because he's helpless. Full of sores. Now, it's one thing to be immobile and be at the mercy of the generosity and the help of others, but it's something worse to have a condition that is repulsive to those who might see one. You know, here's a man, if you saw him on the street and he's full of sores, you might be tempted to give him a wide berth and not go near him. What does he have? Is that leprosy? You know, leprosy is highly contagious. There's no cure for it. So here's a man that, you know, how embarrassing would that be and how discouraging would that be for, you know, needing a handout, and here comes a couple of people down the road, and then they see you and they look the other way and they... Are you getting a picture for how this man, how low this man is? Rich man up, best of everything, poor man down. It says, moreover, the dogs, and desiring to be fed with the crumbs which fell from the rich man's table. Now this is interesting, at least to me, that in those days they had the very rich. There were different kinds of bread, like we have different kinds of bread, but barley bread was considered to be cheap. Only the very poor would eat barley bread. But the rich would have a loaf baked, and they would break it open after a meal was over, take out the soft part, and use it like we would use a napkin. Wipe the hands and the face, and then discard it. That's what this poor man's wanting. He's wanting the rich man's barley bread. What he wouldn't eat himself, the poor man is hungry enough to eat. Moreover, the dogs came and licked his sores. There's two ideas about that. One is that there was some medicinal value in having the wounds cleaned by the tongue of the dog, and maybe that might be the case, but... Well, if you had a sore, would you let a dog lick it? Probably not, you know? So more likely, the second interpretation is what is intended. He's so weak, he can't even drive away the dogs that come and lick his body unwanted. He's low. He's very low. Rich man up, poor man down. Now, if the story ended there and you had an opportunity to trade places with one of these two individuals, there's not anybody in here who would say, I want to be Lazarus. You know, I want to be the sick guy. I want to be the poor man. I want to be the hungry one. I want to be the one that can't get around and take care of himself. Nobody would say that. Everybody would say, I want to live in the big house and eat the good food, wear the nice clothes. But the story doesn't end here. That's the first picture. Rich man up, poor man down. Second picture, you see the seesaw in your mind? Rich man, poor man, level. Because the next verse says, and it came to pass that the beggar died. I guess that didn't surprise anybody. And notice in the last part of the verse, the rich man also died. Now what's the difference? There's no difference. Well, there's a difference in the rich man was buried. There's no burial mention of the poor man. But they both died. Proverbs 22:2 says, the rich and the poor, they meet together in death. And it doesn't matter what size house you live in, what size inheritance you may leave to those of your loved ones. It doesn't matter how many offices you've been elected to. You will suffer the same fate or the same end as the one on the other end of the spectrum. Maybe you live in the big house on the hill in a nice community, but you will eventually die just like the person that lives in the government housing over on the backside of a town where you wouldn't want to go at night. You're both going to die. And the rich and the poor meet together in death. I remember that C.S. Lewis said, The statistics on death are pretty impressive. So far, it's been one out of one. You know? There have only been a couple of exceptions, and that because of the miraculous power of God that, you know, take it to the heaven in a chariot didn't die. Some have died twice, though, so that averages it back out, like Lazarus, raised from the dead, but he had to die again. So what's the point? We don't like to think about it. We don't like to talk about it. A lot of people don't have wills because that means they'd have to think about it, make decisions, and they just don't want to think about death. It doesn't matter if we think about it or plan for it, it's coming. It may come soon, we hope it comes later, but it's coming. And the wise person is one that spends some time in this book. Because this is the only book that can tell you from where you've come, why you're here, and where you're going. We're made in the image of God, not up from the animals, a graduated ape on the tree of time. That's not us. We're down from God one step, made a little lower than the angels, in God's own image, Genesis 1:26 and 27. And made not to be fodder for the flames of hell, but to be children of God who dwell with Him eternally. That's what He desires of us. Now the gate that ushers us into that world is death. And from the Christian perspective, there are worse things than death, I can tell you. Because it is a gate to the blessings of God. Paul said, for me to die is, what was that? Gain. Philippians 1. You can start reading about verse 13 down through 22. But it was needful for him to remain, he said. And we probably share that feeling with Paul. Maybe we're not quite as strong in the faith that we're ready to go like he, but we hadn't suffered as much as he did either, you know. But he said, I have some things I need to do, and you probably feel that way. I feel that way. There are some people I still hope to reach with the gospel. I want to see my children reared in the faith and establish their own homes and maybe get to see those grandchildren one day. There are some things here that tie us. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't want to go or that it's not going to be great to go. But we live between two worlds. But death is the door between those two worlds. Now the main thing is not when death comes. You may live to be a century. Or you may not. You may not live out the week. I'm not trying to be morbid. I don't want to scare anyone. I'm just saying that's reality. You know, we've had a couple of funerals that have been announced. I'm sorry for those that are hurting because of untimely loss. But we know that that can happen to any of us at any time. Car accident, stroke, or a heart attack, or, you know, we have to be ready at any time. The old must die, but the young do die, right? So eventually that day will come. That's what happened here. The rich man died, the poor man. Well, the other order, the poor man died, the rich man died. Let's read that verse, and then we'll move on to the third picture. It came to pass that the beggar died and was carried by the angels. I want to come back to that in a minute. In Abraham's bosom, the rich man also died and was buried. Now let's picture the third seesaw position. Poor man up, rich man down. It's the reverse in the next world of what it was here. Let me talk about the rich man first. We'll end on the happy note. Rich man down. In hell, verse 23, that's the word Hades. It simply means the unseen world. Again, I'm going to ask you to visualize with me. Man's existence. Three circles, two lines. Circle. Line, circle, line, circle. You have that picture in your mind? Now, across your circles, draw a line in the middle. That represents the human experience. First circle, earthly life. Top half of the circle, the Christian life. Bottom half, the unbeliever's life. Now, it's not exactly equal as we saw last night. Majority will be lost. But for the sake of this illustration, you have a circle, you have two groups in the circle. The first line represents what we just discussed, that transition from one world to the next. The first line is death. So, earthly existence, death, circle, line. The second circle, the Hadean world, Hades. Now, we may think of Hades as being the place of fire and suffering, But that's only half the story. Remember, there's a line through this circle too. Both Lazarus and the rich man were in Hades. There's two compartments. The poor man is in what's called, in this passage, Abraham's bosom. Other places call it paradise. Today shalt thou be with me in paradise, for instance, Luke 23:43, when Jesus was talking to the thief on the cross. The bottom half of that circle is Tartarus, or what we think of as Hades, the place where the rich man was. So you pass over, and if you're in that top half of the circle here, then you'll be in the top half of the next circle, just like Lazarus was. But if you're unsaved in this world, you don't somehow die lost and wake up saved in the good place in the next world. You just pass over into the bottom half of the next circle. And then that continues until the second line hasn't occurred yet. Judgment Day. Matthew 25:31-33 talks about when all nations will be brought before Jesus and He will separate them as the shepherd divides the sheep from the goats. Now, I guess it's obvious that you'll know what your eternal destination is in the second circle in the Hadean world. If you're happy, then that means you can look forward to a favorable judgment. If you're suffering, then you're not going to have a favorable judgment. You say, well, why have a judgment at all then? So you'll know why. Every deed of life will be judged, 2 Corinthians 5:10. In Matthew 7:21-23, speaks of those who want to argue on the judgment day. Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in thy name, and in thy name cast out devils, and in thy name done many wonderful works? But they're surprised. Wait a minute. And then he will say, I never knew you, depart from me, or I know you not, depart from me. So that's what the second line is. The third circle is eternity. Upper half heaven, lower half hell. Now what we are in this, what we're talking about here, is the second circle, the Hadean world. The rich man lifted up his eyes, being in hell, or you may have a translation that says Hades. There are two words translated hell in the King James Version. Hades, which is the word used here, and the word Gehenna, which is the eternal place of suffering. All right, let's read more about this place. There are 4 points that we'll make from this. And Herod lifted up his eyes, being in torments. That word, I think, is used 4 times. You can count it in your own Bible. And he seeth Abraham afar off, and Lazarus in his bosom. And he cried and said, Father Abraham, have mercy on me. I read somewhere that there was an ancient form of torture where a prisoner would be chained by the leg to a post. And then a fantastic feast was prepared and placed on a low table just beyond where he could reach. And he was starved to death within sight and smell of food. Somehow that seems even worse than just being in a dungeon and starving to death. This man could see Abraham and Lazarus. I suppose he could see the joy on the other side. I mean, they were close enough to have a conversation, even though this is described as a great gulf between the two. I don't know if that'll be the case in eternity, but I can imagine how horrible it would be to be lost, but to be able to see the saved, but not get to participate. And it says he cried. I suppose this man had never begged before. He probably had a servant's bell, you know. Ding, ding, bring me some water. Bring me a meal. Bring my robe, you know. He wasn't used to begging. He was used to commanding. The beggar was Lazarus, but now the seesaw swapped places, hasn't it? Now the rich man's the beggar, and the beggar's the rich man. Send Lazarus that he may dip the tip. dip, that's the word I mentioned last night, that's the word baptize. Baptize his finger in water, you know, submerge it and bring it out. The first point that we'll make here is hell is a place of unquenched thirst. I've given some thought to this, and you may have too, but here's a man who is in a position where he is in a fire, so he's thirsty. Have you ever been really thirsty? I guess we all have some experience here. I remember visiting one of our members. He's gone on to his reward now, but some years ago, he was to have surgery, so he had to, you know, not eat or drink anything the night before. He was got there, supposed to be the first of the list, but there was a car accident, and several people came in that were emergencies, and so they pushed him back, and they took care of all the emergency cases. And then he had his surgery later in the afternoon, and I was busy that day and hadn't got around, but I got around to visiting him about 6 p.m. And by this time, he had been without anything to drink since about 24 hours. And I was in there when the nurse came in, and she said, the doctor said that you can have I can swab your mouth with water. Is that a word you use here, swab? No? Well, she took a little foam, like a straw, dipped it in some water, and went over his lips with it. He didn't get much water, but I remember seeing the look on his face. You would have thought he had had something really wonderful. He was so thirsty. I suppose that thirst is nothing compared to what the rich man is experiencing here. You know, if I had been the rich man, I don't think that I would have made this request. Not the same one. Abraham, send Lazarus over here with a tanker truck of water, you know. But he knew he couldn't get that much water. Send Lazarus over here with a barrel of water so I could get in it, you know, just be relieved for a few minutes. They'll never do that. Send Lazarus over here with a gallon of water. I'll pour it over my head, I'll drink it, I'll save it, and I'll spread it out over a gallon. If I just had a gallon of water... They're not going to bring me that. Would you bring me a cup? If I just had a glass of water, oh, it'd be so wonderful to sip it and maybe to drink a little bit and then to run it through my mouth and just to feel the... He had come to the point that he was lusting after the amount of water that would adhere to a man's finger when he dipped it in a glass and brought it out. But even that was denied him in hell. No water. Unslakable thirst. I mentioned on Sunday night when we talked about Jesus being tempted that the desire to survive is the strongest physical desire that we have in the body. And we mentioned hunger there. But actually, thirst, I understand, is a greater desire if you've been deprived of both than even food. So here you have this man who is so thirsty, but there's no hope for any water to be given. And then it says, for I am tormented in this flame. So hell is a place, unslakable thirst, and then unquenchable fire. Of all deaths that one might die, suppose none is feared more than to be burned to death. At least few deaths would be above that. There are certain sections of the hospital, large city hospitals, that preachers don't really like to visit. One is the children's ward. You know, we do, and we support family. We love them, you know. Boy, sometimes you have to wait outside for a moment, steel yourself before you go in. This child who's fighting leukemia. There's another, though. It's the burn ward. That's a hard visit to make. This man was burned. He was burning, tormented in this flame. I read somewhere that if you were in a horrible fire, like a house fire, that the physical pain would only last a certain length of time. Your nerve endings would be to the point where they no longer worked. I don't remember the length. It seemed like it was a minute or something. But his nerves still worked. I'm tormented in this flame. You know, I've thought about, there'll be firemen in hell, you know, just like there'll be preachers there and every other kind of occupation. But the fireman's training won't do him any good there. Stop, drop, and roll. It won't help there. No water to put out a fire, no chemicals. No amount of training to somehow. It's a lake that burns with fire. In fact, it's called an oven of fire, a furnace of fire. That's Matthew 13, I think verse 52. I guess that refers to its confining nature. It's called a lake of fire. That's how vast it is. It's called a baptism of fire. A baptism in the... You know, sometimes you'll hear people praying for the baptism of fire. Friends, you don't want that. That's the one thing you don't want. Because Matthew 3, Jesus talked about that. Well, baptism just means to be overwhelmed or to be covered. And the element that you're covered in is determined from the context. We've been talking about water baptism. There's also baptism of the Holy Spirit. And there's baptism in fire, baptism in suffering, baptism under Moses. There's a lot of different baptisms in the Bible. But this was the one you don't want. So when you put the three together, the oven, the baptism, and the lake of fire, what you have is you take the baptism first. So there, you know, a lake might not cover the whole body. You know, it might be waist deep. But the baptism assures that the whole body is covered. Then the lake indicates a vastness. So you wouldn't have to take turns with other people. Everybody's in it at the same time. And then the furnace indicates an oven. And so if somehow you could get out of the lake or get part of you out of the lake, it'd be in the furnace. So it wouldn't be a relief. I know this isn't comfortable to hear. It's not really comfortable to talk about. I look forward to talking about heaven a lot more tomorrow night. But we need to talk about this. Because just because we don't like it doesn't mean it's not real. And just because it might make us uncomfortable, I'd rather make us uncomfortable tonight and someone say, I'm not going to that place, I tell you what, than to get to the judgment day and for them to hear those words, depart from me and go to that place. And this chapter is in the Bible for a reason. It also says that he had unrelieved pain, torment. There's no nurse there. There's no medicine. There's no salve. There's no mercy. You know, it helps. Even if you have a terminal condition, if hospice comes in, and those folks are wonderful, the ones I've dealt with, I tell you, they are well-trained and compassionate people. And even though there might not be long-term hope, having someone who cares and that can come in and administer medicine and advice and is so helpful. But in hell, there's no hospice. It's just pain. And then the fourth one, there is unending duration, and that's in verse 26. Beside all this, between us and you, there is a great gulf fixed. You know, you wouldn't need all three of those words, really, to communicate the idea. You could have just said there's a gulf between us. And the Bible doesn't usually use superfluous words, so why a great gulf fixed? Well, obviously, there must be a meaning to it. It's a gulf, but it's a great gulf, so that the strongest sinner in hell could not somehow get a running go and jump over it. the most compassionate saint in heaven could not somehow bridge it. It's a great gulf. It's the word we get chasm from. It's a great gulf fixed. What does the fixed mean? It's never going to change. There's never going to be a bridge. It's never going to somehow come together. It's fixed. And once the door closes, it will never be opened. I love to read, but I didn't get a lot out of literature class. My wife was a literature teacher in college, and so she has a love for some things that I don't. But I remember, I didn't know her when I took literature class at Faulkner University so many years ago. But I remember we read Dante's Inferno, was it? I don't remember much about it, but I do remember that he pictured the door over hell as having a sign that said, "Abandon all hope, ye who enter here." And that struck me, as you can tell, all these years later, I can still quote that one line. And that's true. It's a great gulf fixed. Did you ever hear V.P. Black talk about eternity, the great gospel preacher? He used to talk about how long eternity is. We don't have time to talk about that tonight, but let me just give you one or two real quick. He would talk about a bird, an iron ball the size of the earth, and a bird would fly by it and brush his wing against it once every 1,000 years. And by the time he wore all the way through that iron ball, eternity just started. He'd talk about that bird getting a grain of sand and flying it to the moon and depositing it and flying back and getting another grain of sand and flying back. And when he had emptied all the beaches of the earth of all the sand and put it on the moon and brought it back, you're still in the early morning of eternity. One termite eating all the trees and buildings of the earth. By the time he's eaten New York City, Memphis, Atlanta, Jacksonville, Orlando, Los Angeles, Moscow. Eternity just started. Unending. But I want to close. I feel like it's about that time. I'm talking about poor man up. We've got the hard part over. Let's talk about the good part. It says, Lazarus died and was carried by the angels. Maybe that's just filler. Maybe that's just color for the story. But it seems to me that Jesus didn't do color didn't do filler. So I wonder if that's not, Hebrews 1 talks about angels are ministers sent on behalf of Christians. So maybe that's one of their assignments. I read a long time ago about, and I believe he was an Egyptian king, who had conquered many nations. And instead of executing the kings, they were brought back to his capital. And he had a great parade celebrating his victories. And he rode in a great chariot of gold, beautiful jewels. And harnessed to that chariot were not great stallions, but were great kings. And they pulled him through his streets in his chariot. Honored by having kings pull your chariot. Well, it wasn't a king that was sent, or kings, but angels to Lazarus. I suppose one angel would be more than sufficient to do the job. Why send more than one? Honor. Go get Lazarus, he's one of mine. And so the angels go and they bring him into Abraham's bosom. We're going to talk about heaven tomorrow night, so I'm not going to spill the beans on much of that. But boy, it's a wonderful place. But we won't talk about Abraham's bosom tomorrow night, so let me touch on what that means. Of course, Abraham was the most revered man in Judaism, the father of the faithful, father of the Jewish nation. And in those days, they had a lot of banquets. much like we do today, but they didn't have tables that were this height that had chairs, and you might, you know, sit, then you might prop up on an elbow at a table, but probably not. They had short tables, about 12 or 15 inches tall. And instead of having chairs, they had rugs or pillows. And so you would, you know, the great banquet would have this long table, sometimes in a circle, and they would have assigned seating like we do sometimes. And the best seat in the house was to be right beside the host, what's called in the bosom, because he's propped up on his elbow, and you can have personal conversation that way with the most important person there. And that's what the picture is here. To a Jew, to think about even getting to meet Abraham, but you mean I get to eat with him? And you mean I get to sit next to Abraham? The hopes of the Jews to say, I want to go to heaven. I want to be in Abraham's bosom. Well, tomorrow night we'll talk more about how wonderful heaven is. But there might not be a tomorrow night. You know, we've talked about that tonight. In the first picture in this story, rich man up, everything's going his way, poor man down, nobody would trade places with him. But that changed at death, and they were made equal. Poor man died, rich man died, rich man was buried. Lazarus was carried by the angels into Abraham's bosom, and he, lifting up his eyes, said, I'm tormented in this flame. So poor man down, rich man up. That's a picture of the life cycle of everybody in here. You know, we're on that seesaw. We might not be lower than all, but we're lower than some. Or we might not be higher than all, but we're higher than many. But eventually that day is going to come when the seesaw levels. And then we will be ushered into one of these two places. Either Abraham's bosom or Tartarus, where we await the judgment day. And ultimately then we'll be ushered into an eternity with God or eternity without God. Now, gospel meetings are good because they give us an opportunity to pause from the regular routine of life and to put ourselves under the preaching of the gospel. You know, if this week had not been a gospel meeting, you probably wouldn't have studied the Bible as much as you have this week. You wouldn't have been around these brothers and sisters who have the same goals that you have. You wouldn't have sung these great songs to stir your heart. Here we are nearing the end. I may say this tomorrow night, but I'm going to say it tonight. It'd be a shame for me to drive 14 hours round trip to come here, this church, to spend the money for lodging and all that will go into this meeting, for you to take the time to come, rearrange your schedule, and for the same people who were lost on Sunday to still be lost when the meeting comes to an end. I won't say we've wasted our time because the gospel's been preached, but as far as that person is concerned, the meeting has not been effective. They did not make the decision they needed to make. Now, I do not know where you are spiritually. You know, there's no thermometer that I can see what your spiritual temperature is. There's no red ticket, blue ticket that I can see. But you got one, and I have one. And most likely, we all know what our ticket is. If your ticket is blue, representing heaven, then I hope that you will sing with enthusiasm in this song so that you might encourage someone else. But if your ticket is not for heaven right now, God will trade with you. He'll say, let me have that ticket, and I'll give you one. If you need to be baptized into Christ tonight, all your sins will be washed away by the blood of Christ, Acts 22 and 16. Based on your confession of faith in Jesus as the Son of God, you're turning from sin and repentance, as the Ethiopian did in Acts 8, 35 to 40. If you haven't been a faithful Christian, at some time in the past you were baptized into Christ and you lived faithfully for some time, but at this point you can't honestly say, I'm ready for the judgment day. You say, well, what will people think? Wrong question. What will God think? Right question. But I can tell you what the people will think. Victor and I have been preaching probably about the same length of time. He's a lot older than me, but... You know, after a while, you sort of know, you talk to enough people. I can tell you what the people here are going to think if you respond and say, I've sinned. They're not going to say, what'd she do? She's a bad person. They're going to put their arms around you. They're going to say, I love you. And I'm going to be praying for you. And let's go to heaven together. More importantly, though, God in heaven, pictured as that prodigal father, will rush from where he is. Only time God ever runs. He will run from heaven to meet you at the front with forgiveness in hand. Kill the fatted calf. Bring the robe. Bring the ring. Bring the shoes for his feet. God loves you that much. And he wants you to live with him forever. He doesn't want you to lose out on what he's prepared for you. Now, if you're okay, don't respond. But if you're not okay, be the first to respond. And your good example might even lead someone else a little more timid than you to also respond. Will you come? We'll stand while we sing.